Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Solari Report Patty Kammerer, who is a CPA. In fact, she's Solari's CPA and my personal CPA. She is a partner and founder of Kammerer Schooley in Virginia CPAs. And one of the reasons I always ask Patty to help us at year end is she has remarkable breadth across all sectors, from business, both large and small, to not-for-profits, to individuals. And so she has a remarkable grasp of the tax issues and financial planning issues that hit everyone across all these different sectors at year end. So, Patty, thank you again. I know this is a very busy time of the year for you, and so I really appreciate you joining us on the Solari Report.
My pleasure. Happy to be back.
Okay, well, I wanted to start. I've asked you to be prepared to talk about some of the changes that may be in the wind, and there's a lot of interest in that. But let's just start with current law. So what we know for a fact, is the current law, although some of it could be changed. Let's look. We have provisions expiring and a lot this year, and then new ones coming in. So let's just start there. Under current law, what are the provisions that are expiring at the end of 2016 that we should be aware of?
Well, there's a lot of them. There's more than 30 total provisions expiring, but I just wanted to touch on the ones that I see most often and that seem to be the most popular. Now, of course, these could always be retroactively reinstated, but as of now, these are scheduled to expire at the end of 2016. One of them is the income exclusion for discharge of principal residence debt. If someone, their house goes to foreclosure or they have a short sale and they are forgiven the debt that they owe to the mortgage company up to $2 million, if it's been their principal residence, they've been able to exclude that up to $2 million for the last several years. That particular law is set to expire at the end of this year.
So let me just underscore what that means, because I think this one is very big. In 2017, if this is not reinstated, if you default on your mortgage, you go to foreclosure, it's in all states. It's not just in certain states.
This is federal.
The mortgage that has written down, so let's say you have a $500,000 mortgage, it's written down fully, you have $500,000 of income that needs to be declared.
That's correct.
Right.
That is correct. Now, there are other alternatives that you could possibly still not have to claim that income. For example, if the taxpayer is insolvent at the time that the debt is discharged, that would allow them to escape having to claim the income. But not everyone that is foreclosed upon is actually insolvent.
Insolvent. Okay, so I know we're not going to discuss all 30, but let's keep going.
Sure. One of the things that people have enjoyed is a deduction for qualified higher education expenses. This is not the higher education credits for the American Opportunity Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit. This is actually a deduction that's on the front of the 1040 that if you don't qualify to take the deduction or the credits, and the deduction is actually larger, you're going to want to take the deduction perhaps. But that particular law is going away at the end of this year. So the credits are still available, but the deduction will no longer be available. And that's what we call an above-the-line deduction, where it's deducted from your other income before taxes applied. It's not actually a credit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that's going away. Then we also have credits for qualified energy-efficient home improvements that will expire at the end of the year. And those are things like insulation, exterior doors and windows, skylights, certain roofing materials, electric heat pumps and water heaters, central air, gas, propane, or oil water heaters, furnaces, or hot water boilers. The maximum credit over a lifetime is only $500, but that's a credit. When we say a credit versus a deduction, a credit is a dollar for dollar reduction in tax.
Right.
So it's a $500 credit that people have been allowed to take over the last several years. There's a maximum $200 credit for windows, $150 for boilers, and $300 for everything else. If you are thinking about getting new windows, new doors, a new furnace, what have you, now's the time to do it because it has to be in service by December 31. It can't just be under contract to be put in. It actually has to be in order to get the credit. So that's what people need to know. If you're thinking about doing it, you still have, you know, about 3 weeks to get it done before the end of the year. So that's something that you might want to consider doing if it was something that was on your list to do anyway. Also, the upfront deduction for energy efficient improvements to commercial buildings is also set to expire at the end of this year. One other one that is changing is the medical expense deduction. Previously, everyone could deduct their medical expenses that exceeded 7.5% of their AGI, which is their adjusted gross income. A couple of years ago, that changed. Everyone except people over age 65 had to exceed 10% of their adjusted gross income in order to get medical expense deduction on their Schedule A. After 2016, even people over 65 are going up to the 10% threshold. So everyone will be at 10% of their adjusted gross income before they can deduct any medical expenses. Medical expenses include long-term care insurance and health insurance premiums, as well as prescriptions, doctor's visits, lab tests, hospitals, etc. So any out-of-pocket costs.
And for some people, that could be significant. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the what's coming into effect in 2000. Well, it's coming into effect this year.
Well, yeah, it's coming into effect this year. So the Retirement Act of 2015 added five new categories of the list to the list of public safety employees who can start taking their retirements out penalty-free at age 50. So this only applies to this group of employees that are public safety employees. And the ones that were added to the list were federal law enforcement officers, customs officers, border protection officers, firefighters, and air traffic controllers. So all of those folks, along with the original list, which I don't have in front of me, I apologize, are eligible to take their retirement distribution starting at age 50 without penalty. Now, the Trade Act, there were a lot of acts in the last year. The Trade Act increases penalties for failure to file and furnish 1099s. So if you have a business and you're required to file W-2s for your employees and 1099 miscellaneous forms to your contractors, which would be non-employee compensation 1099s, they're doubling the penalty for failure to file and failure to provide those documents to the subcontractors and to the employees.
Do you remember offhand what the penalty is?
Well, for 1099s, it was $50 for a failure to prepare the 1099s. I don't remember what the W-2s are, but now they've doubled that penalty. So if you don't file them and you don't give them to the people, it's $100. And they've upped the limit. I mean, for big corporations, the limit used to be around $150,000 total penalty. Now it's up to almost $600,000. So they've really increased that the limitation on that penalty, so that especially larger corporations are, you know, could really get hurt by not filing things when they're supposed to, and providing them to the payees.
Right.
So another benefit that, you know, everybody's been enjoying is the Section 179 deduction, and we were worried that last year it was going to expire and it was going to drop from $500,000 per year to 20, back to 25,000 per year, which it was years ago. And the law was reinstated for another year, and now it has been permanently reinstated. So,
now explain what the 179 deduction is.
Sure, that is, my apologies. That is a write-off of assets that you purchase for your business.
Right.
So you can deduct up to $500,000 in new purchases for the business, and this has to be fixed assets, things that you're going to actually use in your business, not things that you're going to resell or anything like that. So they have to actually be things that you're going to use in your business. And as long as you don't spend more than $2 million per year on new assets, you can deduct up to $500,000 each year.
Right, and that's very valuable for small business.
It is very valuable.
Yeah, the R&D credit.
Yeah, the R&D credit has been expanded, and qualified small businesses, and you have to be a qualified small business, can elect to claim part or all of the credit for the first time against your employer FICA instead of your income tax if you elect to do that, which is very interesting because the credit is based on wages that you pay to employees that are doing the research and development. So you can actually reduce your employer taxes on those wages if you elect to take the credit against that instead of your income taxes. So that
I'm going to
need
you to send me a very detailed definition or show me where the definition is of research and development.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that.
That is really interesting.
I have a client that's taking it that's an engineering firm, which is very that's kind of an interesting one for research and development, but they're allowed this credit.
That is really intriguing. When did that start? It's just this for 2016.
This is coming. Yeah, this is for 2016. So this is an expansion, and this is a new rule that you can make this election. So it's a valuable rule.
PATH Act.
PATH Act. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on with PATH Act, but this is part of what I was talking about before, where the W-2s and 1099 miscellaneous have to be filed. And the deadline for those filings has been moved up from February 28th, which is when they've always been for years and years, that they had to be filed with the IRS by February 28th. That date has been moved up to January 31st.
Oh yeah, we moved it on the corporate calendar, and there was a big discussion of how that had to have priority over all other things.
Because the penalties have doubled too if you're late.
Right.
So the reason for this is because a lot of fraudulent tax returns are being filed in January and February by people who've stolen Social Security numbers and report Social Security or whatever on their return, and they get big refunds, and it wasn't even their money.
Right.
And, it takes the IRS until May or June to figure this out. Well, by now, the money's spent. It's gone,
right.
It's spent. So in an effort to try to curb some of this, they have moved the deadlines up so that they have access to the information at an earlier date. So that's the reason.
One business colleague who filed for a huge refund. He had a lot coming back to him. And when he filed, he discovered that it had been taken by, a tax identity theft person. And it took him 6 months to get his refund.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you look at the float, it was not an inconsequential amount of money.
Absolutely. Well, I had a client also that had a large refund coming, and they wouldn't give it to him until he could prove that he was really the taxpayer.
I'm sympathetic with the IRS on that one, because if you look at what...
Me too.
...the problems they've had, it's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. Okay, so let's see... So it's just the W-2 and the 1099 miscellaneous,
right,
that has not employee compensation on it. All other 1099s are under the old rules still. So this is just the compensation ones that are required to be filed sooner. So then we also had the Service Transportation and Veterans Healthcare Choice Improvement Act. That's a mouthful. And it covered a whole lot of things. But the thing that was most interesting was that people who have investments in foreign bank accounts or foreign brokerages, and there are a lot of people out there that do, that have $10,000 or more in them at any time during the year, have to file that FBAR, the Foreign Bank Account Report, which is now the FinCEN 114, and it has to be filed online. Right. But it's always been due June 30th, and now it's due April 15th.
Right, which is a bite to a lot of
tax
people.
Return. It is, but they do have the opportunity to file for an extension. The IRS really hasn't told us yet how we're going to file for that extension. But they said there is going to be an extension allowed until October 15th. When the deadline was June 30th, there were no extensions. So at least now we have the opportunity to file for an extension if we can't get it done by April 15th because we're busy doing other things like 1040s. So let
me ask you one question about this, because I used to have a lot of clients who had money in an online depository for their gold, where you could access and buy and sell online. And I was very worried about fraud and the, you know, I never had a deposit stolen from it. Security was very strong, but the Pew Foundation just came out with a new survey, and it said 6% of the American people trust that the data they give to the government is confidential and their privacy will be protected. And frankly, I think that's an optimistic, those 6% are, you know, that's an optimistic percentage as far as I'm concerned. So whenever I've had the clients who had the digital gold file their FBAR and then their FinCEN, I would have them give the last four numbers on the account, but not the first four numbers, just to protect for that reason. And I figured with the last four numbers, they can find the account. They don't, you know, the IRS is not going to have any problem finding or getting the account from the company, but that way you're protected from the kind of tax identity fraud problem that I see is really dangerous. Now, you would probably tell me I'm non-compliant. But
yeah, I was kind of thinking that.
But I was, you know, clearly if you're filing the form and everything is appropriate and properly, you know, there's no intention to defraud. There's only a clear concern about safety. And if you look at how many times this last year the government was hacked and, you know, this kind of data was lost. Anyway, so you don't have to say anything, but I still...
So it was
Has anybody gotten any letters?
Nobody's gotten any letters.
That's good.
Nobody's got, you know, and these are all people who are very, very, you know, very, very faithful in their filing of all the forms and do it all right and everything else. But they are really concerned with confidentiality, as am I. Anyway, so let's move on. Partnership tax returns.
Okay, so partnership tax returns. They've changed the due date for partnership tax returns. Partnership tax returns have always been due on April 15th, and it's been a big hassle for individual taxpayers that are getting K-1s from those partnerships that they have to put onto their own personal returns. So the IRS finally went, hey, you know, maybe we should do something about this. So they moved the date up for filing partnership returns to March 15th, so that the K-1s can be issued in a much more timely manner and so that individuals can get their tax returns filed on time. As a trade-off, they have extended the due date for regular corporations, which we call C-corporations, to April 15th because they don't issue K-1s to the shareholders. They pay the taxes themselves. So the April 15th deadline works pretty well for C corporations, unless you have a June 30 year end. If you have a June 30 year end, you still have to file your returns on September 15th, which is two and a half months after the end of your fiscal year. Right. Calendar year corporations get 3.5 months. June 30 year-end corporations get 2.5 months. I don't know why. Don't ask me. I have no clue. This is above my pay grade. I don't know why it was decided that that was the case. But any other fiscal year-end date still gets the 3.5 months, except June 30.
So let me just ask you, the tax preparers, if they have to meet the C Corp and individuals on the same date, isn't that quite a that seems to me to be a huge burden.
Yeah, it's a burden because we certainly have to figure out if the C corporations are going to owe tax, because unlike S corporations and partnerships that pass through their income to the individuals that own them, the C corporations pay their own taxes. So we have to know if we're going to file an extension, let's say we can't get it done on time, if we have to file an extension, we have to know if they're going to owe tax, and they must pay the tax with their extension, because extensions are extensions of time to file. They are not extensions of
Extensions
time to
to
pay.
pay.
And that's true for individuals, it's true for everything. They're always extensions of time to file, not extensions of time to pay.
Now, the thing that's so interesting about this is for my whole life, the equity markets have all traded around earnings announcements relating to that March 15th date. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the earnings announcements and other announcements work if the tax date has been moved to April 15th.
I
I have no
agree.
idea how this is
Will be
going to work.
interesting.
Yeah, it will be interesting. Okay, on to the really big one, Obamacare.
Yeah, I mean it's big, but it could be changing. Who knows? But for right now, there was a congressional committee report that came out that this whole program is not that old, and already
Right.
more than $750 million in improper Affordable Care Act tax credits may not be recoverable due to errors and fraud. So already this thing is, costing the American taxpayer quite a bit of money, due to errors and fraud. So it'll be interesting to see if anything changes here. Now, starting in 2016, employers with 50 or more employees and or full-time equivalent employees now are subject to the employer shared responsibility provisions. So that means that they must offer minimum coverage to at least 95% of their full-time employees, and a full-time employee works on average at least 30 hours a week, or they have to pay a fine for each month that they're not in compliance. The scary thing about this is that if you've got employees and you have one employee that, a lot of employers are trying to keep their employees at 29 hours a week in order to avoid this whole issue. But let's say you have one employee that trips over the 30 hour a week on average, and they have purchased health insurance from the marketplace. Then, if you haven't offered that person health insurance through your company, you're in non-compliance. And the thing of it is, you may not even know that it's happened until way down the road. So
And
that's.
is the fine per employee or for all the employees, even if it's only one?
Well, that would be the only full-time employee, let's say, because
Ah,
that's the only
okay.
person that has tripped over the 30-hour average. So you have one employee, and then you have to, there's a fine that you have to pay. And I think it's a fixed fee fine, so I don't think it's per employee.
I cannot tell you how many people I talk to who are wildly upset about the penalties on the individuals. So, the businesses tend to grin and bear it.
Yeah, and this is on the business side. It's really been a bit of a problem because employers are trying to keep their employees' hours down. So,
Right.
and they've got to work to make a living. So
Right.
they're ending up, they're doing two or three jobs because they can't get anything more than 29 hours anywhere.
Right.
Particularly, this particularly affects people that work in restaurants and stores and that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's just really made it tough on everyone. And then, of course, there are penalties on individuals that don't have coverage, and that penalty is greater of 2.5% of the total household adjusted gross income, or $695 a month per adult, and $347.50 a month for per child, for a maximum of $2,085. So it's the greater of those two things. So if 2.5% of your total household AGI is greater than $2,085, then you have to pay that larger number.
Right. And so what I'm hearing from families all across America is now they spend about $2,000 in cash every year on going to see the doctor, on the dentist, on healthcare. And now, instead of being able to afford that, they're going to need to use that money to pay the penalty. And so they're going to have to, right, so they're losing 100% of their health care.
Yeah, and it, you know, when this first started, people said, well, I'd rather just pay the penalty because it's cheaper than health care. But that may not be the case any longer.
Right.
And, of course, as we've all heard on the news, the health care rates have skyrocketed as well through the marketplace. So it's kind of a lose-lose.
Well, it's not only that the rates have skyrocketed, but I know a lot of people who had a plan for many years, and then Obamacare hit, and it required them to spend maybe 10 to 25 hours to figure out, you know, because they were forced to change. So they got thrown off. They had to spend 10 to 25 hours, which is not, you know, if you're working three jobs, it's a lot of time. And so now the rates have, for them, gone up 50 to 100%, but they have to spend another 10 to 25 hours to find something new. So if you look at the shadow work involved in this, it's been extraordinary. And it you know, and for many families, you know, they had $100 to $1,000 a month of discretionary income, and it's wiped it out.
Yeah, it's just really tough.
Right. The Speaker of the House, Ryan, has said that the Republicans' number one priority is Obamacare. We don't know what they mean by that, but what they've said is they want to address the immediate pain. And so I'm assuming that both business and individual penalties is part of what they're describing, but we have yet to see. And, you know, frankly, healthcare was one of the biggest things, you know, fueled by Obamacare. Healthcare is what has really driven the U.S. stock market for the last 3 or 4 years. And so it's going to be very interesting. You know, since the election, healthcare stocks have been down a lot. It's going to be very interesting to see how this translates into what happens in the markets.
Absolutely.
Okay, investment income tax.
Yes, this is a net investment income tax.
Right.
And it's 3.5%, which is applied to your investment earnings, such as interest, dividends, capital gains, not to business income, or sale of a business interest, for example. But this is applied, it's just an add-on tax that people who are married filing joint, they have $250,000. Married filing separate, $125,000, and all others, $200,000 of income, this will apply to them. Once they're over that threshold, then they have to pay this tax on their investments.
Right, and with yields coming way, way down over the last couple of years, you know, every taking a bite out of something when you're only getting 1% to 2% is, you know, it doesn't look like a lot, but it's very painful.
Right. And, you know, this law, as well as the next one I'm going to talk about, was all part of the Obamacare.
Right. Right.
So it wasn't all about health care. So this was part of that package. And there was also an additional Medicare tax on wages and self-employment income of 0.9%. For people in the same tax brackets where their adjusted gross is $250 for married filing joint, $125 for married filing separate, and $200 for all others, and that's thousands. So employers are supposed to take care of the 0.9% if it's a W-2 wage, but self-employed persons have to pay that themselves. So they have to take care of paying that in themselves. So those are the thresholds and the rates for 2017 for both of those, net investment income tax and additional Medicare tax. So you want to talk about retirement plans?
Absolutely. Let's dive into retirement plans. That's something that the Solaris subscribers are always very interested in.
Okay, great. So let's talk about those. So if eligible, it's not too late for a business owner to set up a solo 401k. You have until December 31st to set that up. And what a solo 401k is, it's a 401k designed for a business owner that has no employees except perhaps their spouse. If their spouse is an employee, they can still get a solo 401k. So if that's your situation, it's not too late to set that up for 2016. It must be set up by December 31st. It does not have to be funded until the due date of your tax return plus extensions. This is a great benefit because it allows you to take the deferred retirement contribution, which for a person who is under 50 is $18,000 a year, over 50 is $24,000 a year. And then your business can also contribute up to 25% of your self-employment income. So this is huge. This
right.
is a really huge benefit. So if you're in that situation, you may want to talk to your advisor about opening a 401k before the end of the year if you have, you know, the money to put in there. And you do have until, if you extend your return to October 15th, you have until October 15th to fund the retirement
right.
plan.
Particularly if that money's going to get taxed. You know, so if that's a great way to shelter income.
Right, it shelters your income taxes, but it doesn't shelter your self-employment tax.
Right.
So that's
right.
one thing that you need to know as a business owner, a self-employed business owner, it does not shelter your self-employment tax. The deduction for the retirement is actually on the front of your return, not on your Schedule C business income form. So, but at least you can shelter your income tax, federal and state, by making
right.
contributions. And it's still your money. Granted, it
right.
has restrictions about when you can take it out and this and that, but you're taking it from your right pocket and putting it in your left pocket for that day down the road. So it's still
right.
your money. So it's a great thing. Now, if you have employees in your business and you haven't set it up, it's already too late. You needed to
right.
Set that up by October 1st.
Okay.
So if you have other employees besides yourself and your spouse, you've missed that deadline. But there's still time to open a SEP, which is a self-employed pension plan, and you don't have to open that until you're ready to fund it. So if you're filing your returns on April 15th, I believe it's actually April 18th this year, you need to get that open and funded by a few days before the deadline, because it has to be
right.
funded by the deadline. But you don't even have to open it until you're ready to fund it.
Okay. Now
something that you can decide as you get closer to the deadline.
Now, IRAs, what can we do?
Well, you can, you know, there's still the ability to contribute to Roth or traditional IRAs. You contribute, they have to be contributed to by April 15th, or in this case, I think it's April 18th, of 2017 for 2016. And the Roth, of course, is after-tax dollars when you put it into the account. So you don't get a deduction for it, but it
right.
does have deferred earnings. And it's, if you follow all the rules, it's not taxable when you take it out down
right.
the road
right.
at retirement age. Now, a traditional IRA, if you don't qualify for a Roth, and some people don't because they just make too much money and then, you know, they don't qualify for a Roth, you can put money into a traditional IRA. Now, it may or may not be deductible depending on whether or not you have a retirement plan or your spouse has a retirement plan from another company that they're contributing to, and also depending upon what your income, your adjusted gross income is for the year. So if you can't fund a Roth, but you can fund a traditional, you can fund the traditional and then later roll it over to the Roth if you really want to do the Roth.
Right.
If it was a deductible contribution to a traditional IRA, you would have to pay the tax on it at the time of the rollover. If it was already not taxable when you contribute it because you're allowed to contribute it, but your spouse is in a retirement plan and you guys make too much money for the deduction, then that's an easy, you know, rollover into the Roth without really having much of any impact on your tax situation if you do it fairly soon.
Now, Patty, what about withdrawals? People who are required to withdraw because they're over 70 and a half, when do they have to make their withdrawals by?
Yeah, it's at age 70 and a half. You have until April 15th of the year following the year that you turn 70 and a half to make your first withdrawal.
Right.
But then that same year you have to make your second withdrawal because
right.
you're now 71 and a half.
Right.
So, but you do have until April 15th of the following year to make the first
to
one.
To do it.
Right. Now, some people are interested in this, in contributing their IRA contribution to a charity. And
mm-hmm.
if you're interested in doing that, the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2016, which is another act that was passed, made this a permanent option for people who are over 70 and a half. And it permits you to make an annual direct transfer from your IRA to a qualified charity. And if you
mm-hmm.
do that, you don't have to report the distribution on your tax return. And this is a benefit if it would, you know, you'd like to give to this charity, but you don't have to report it, and thereby you don't have an increase in your Medicare premiums because you don't trip over that number. I forget what the magic number is, that you have to stay under in order to keep your premiums down. And also, it won't put your income up more so that you pay more on your Social Security income if you're
right.
in that lower tax, if you're in that lower tax bracket. So it's a great way to fund a charity of your choice without having to report the income.
Right. Right. And it doesn't sound like it should be a benefit, but once you start getting into the entanglement of Social Security and Medicare, it's a huge benefit. Okay,
exactly,
so
because you got to keep that income down.
So let's say I'm sitting here and I'm looking towards the end of the year. Just under current law, it seems to me I really need to review my retirement situation. I really need to review my healthcare situation. I need to make sure I've got it calendared and scheduled to make the tax deadlines, whether it's the 1099 or, you know, filing my taxes in March or April. And the other thing I've got to say, because this is important each and every year, make sure you have all your documentation and you have redundant copies of all your documentation. So I would say, you know, proper archiving of all your records and reports is critical, particularly if they're lucky enough to have a CPA such as you and they need to make sure they get all their documentation into you. When do they need to make sure they've got their, if you're going to file on April 15th for a small business or an individual, when do you really need all the documentation, both to make sure they've made their estimated payments and to file, you know, in a smooth and professional process?
Well, in our firm, we ask for the documentation at least 5 weeks ahead of the deadline. Different firms vary depending on, you know, their resources. But I would plan certainly no later than March 15th to get everything into your CPA
right.
in order to ensure that they can get it done by April 18th, unless they've given you an earlier date.
And estimated payments, when are they due?
The first estimated tax payment for 2017 is due on April 18th, same day as the tax returns are due.
But the last estimated for 2016, the last time you can make it is mid-January?
January 15th. And if you're in a state that you pay estimated taxes to, we always recommend to our clients that they pay those by December 31st of this
Right.
year, because if you don't pay them until January, you can't deduct them on this year's return. You have to wait until next year's return to deduct them. You only can deduct them in the year that you actually pay them.
Right. But the other thing is, if tax rates do get lowered, you definitely want to take that deduction this year.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I guess we can talk about some of those proposals.
Yeah. So let's go into what if land and take a look at the GOP proposals first. What
sure.
is the GOP? What has the GOP been proposing for tax
okay.
reform?
Well, right now we have 7 tax brackets for individuals, and they're proposing 3. Our highest tax bracket right now is 39.6%. And under the GOP proposal, there would be 3 brackets, 0 to 12%, 25%, and 33% would be the highest. Sole proprietorships and small businesses that are passing through net income, like S corporations and partnerships, that are passing
uh-huh.
their income through to individuals, that income is capped at 25%. So this is, you know, this sounds like a pretty decent deal that,
right.
You know, even if the rest of your income pushes you into the 33% bracket, your tax on your business income from self-employment or K-1s is capped at 25%, which is great.
Right.
They also want to repeal that pesky alternative minimum tax. This is one of the most confusing and crazy parts of the tax code, quite frankly. Thank goodness we have software that can figure this all out for us, because it would take us hours and hours and hours to sit down and figure this all out with a pencil and a piece of paper. And they want to repeal that, which is also a really great thing, because it really does increase people's taxes if they're in a certain bracket, and it's really kind of interesting the way it falls. People like between 200, 250, and 400, 500, 600 get hit with it, and then
mm-hmm.
once you get over like 750,000 in taxable income, it goes away. So it's just kind of, it really hits the middle income taxpayers the hardest.
Right, it's kind of like, if we can't get you any other way, we'll come back and get you this way.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Exactly. And I personally I'd love to see it go away. It's just a headache, among other things. Among being costly, it's a headache. So they're also proposing a 50% deduction on net capital gains, dividends, and interest income. So if you have capital gains from sales of securities, you have dividends, you have interest, you can just whack 50% of it off the top, and then you pay tax on the other 50%, which is great, because that effectively reduces those rates that I already spoke about, the 12, the 25, and the 33, cuts those in half on your investment income.
Right, and then it's simpler.
It's much simpler.
Right.
They're actually proposing sort of a postcard tax return for those who are eligible, which is also very interesting.
I would love that. Well, the House has always been very, very big on simplification, because if you look at
right.
the costs, the more complex the system is, the more very costly it is for everybody involved. Okay, keep going.
All right, so they're also proposing to consolidate the basic standard deduction, the additional standard deduction for blind and elderly, and the personal exemptions into a single deduction of $24,000 for married filing joint and $18,000 for single individuals with a child in the household, $12,000 for all others. So, and this amount will be adjusted annually for inflation. So instead of claiming so many exemptions and so many, you know, deductions for blind and so forth, there's just going to be one flat deduction that you can take that will be all wrapped up wrap up all those things into one number.
So are you saying it's the same for a family with one child as it is for a family with 8 children?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what they're talking about.
Does that mean that, large families are going to get significantly impacted?
That could happen.
Yes.
Okay. It's yet to be seen, but it could definitely happen.
Okay.
In theory, if you got eight kids, you hopefully, you know, in theory, you're making enough money to support them all, so maybe you're in a higher tax bracket anyway. So you just have to kind of see how all these things shake out. Now, the child tax credit for each child, you can still get. So there's the carrot. Right now it's $1,000 under current law. They're proposing $1,500 per child, and they're also adding a $500 credit for non-child dependents, such as an elderly parent.
Right.
So that was never there before. So you've got this standard number that you're going to use, and then you've got these add-ons for the number of kids and other dependents that you have. So they give it, they take it away, you know. That's kind of the way that works. And for middle-income families, in their proposal, they say for middle-income families, but they don't define exactly what they mean by that. You know, what do they consider middle income? I'm not sure. I don't have the answer. But all itemized deductions except mortgage interest and charitable donations are eliminated under this proposal. So no more real estate taxes, no more state income taxes, property taxes, etc.
State income taxes don't?
Correct. They would not be deductible any longer under this proposal.
Well, you know, it's really funny because the Republicans have never, you know, since Reagan, they haven't won California. So I guess this is get California back.
Perhaps.
Whoa. And no property taxes.
Right. So that's, you know, all kind of supposed to be rolled into that flat deduction.
Well, I'll tell you something.
I think they still want to incentivize people to buy homes.
Right, but if they try and push for vouchers on, you know, for educational reform, and those vouchers come with federal requirements, but it's being funded by local property taxes, but you're not allowed to deduct those property taxes, the politics of that is going to be really very interesting.
It will be.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so...
By the way, these proposals all came out in June, so...
Right, so who knows?
They're already 6 months old. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Right. The Republicans have been proposing tax reform for many, many years, and every year they do it, and every year they come back, you know, somebody comes back and says, no, that's never going to happen. Part is it's, you know, it's complicated. This is very complicated, and it dovetails with the appropriations bill, but now we... You know, and we'll get there. We have a president-elect who's absolutely committed to tax reform. So let's take a look at the first, let's do special interest provisions.
Yeah, they want to repeal special interest provisions, but they from what I've read, they haven't really defined what those are. So the special interest groups, I'm not exactly sure where they're going with that, so we're going to have to wait and see.
So it may be, in theory, not possible to deduct auto loans.
Possibly.
Okay. Okay, so let's take a look at the business proposals.
Okay, so under this is still all the GOP proposals. So they want to allow full and immediate write-offs of investment of intangible and intangible assets, everything except land, which is great because that kind of, the Section 179 that we were talking about is limited to $500,000. Well, that just blows it away and just says whatever you spend, you can deduct it.
That's fabulous.
In the year that you buy it, they're trying to incentivize economic growth with all of these proposals.
Well, you know, part of the problem, Patty, is the software guys have been able to essentially do that. Because if you look at what's involved in creating software, and it's given them a huge advantage up against the guys who, you know, produce the energy and grow the food. So anybody doing concrete stuff has a long depreciation schedule, while Silicon Valley and Hollywood are, you know, Yahoo deducting everything 100% up front. So to a certain extent, I think this is probably leveling the playing field.
I agree, and I think it's, you know, I think it's going to be great if they can get this through.
Oh, it would be fantastic.
Yeah, and then again, they were talking about the 25% on the of tax on the sole proprietor and pass through business net income. So that's cap
also
on that.
Fabulous. Yeah,
it is fabulous. Okay, and here's another thing that's really interesting. Sole proprietors and pass throughs will deduct compensation paid or treated as having been paid, reasonable compensation to owners. And previously, like a Schedule C person that is a sole proprietorship and they put all their business income and expenses on Schedule C, net income is what they took as their, you know, deduction.
Right.
as their income from self-employment. Well, now they can take a reasonable salary out of their Schedule C income. And I'm assuming, and you know what they say about assuming, you should never assume, but I'm assuming only the compensation piece would be subject to Social Security and Medicare tax. And the net income that's left over, like with an S corporation or a part, well, with an S corporation in particular, whatever net income is left over after taking a reasonable salary would not be subject to FICA. But that's just an assumption on my part. I have nothing to base that on whatsoever.
Right.
It just makes sense to me, which means that doesn't mean a thing.
Right.
Because it just makes sense to me. But, you know, they would have to put their wage income there from their business on the front of the Schedule C with the wages as if they were being paid by somebody else. So,
right.
And possibly, depending on the rest of their income, the wage income that they're taking out of their business could be taxed at a higher rate than 25%, possibly.
Right. Right.
So.
Well, the clear intention is to make life easier for the sole proprietor.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's one of the, over the last, you know, 30 plus years that I've been doing this, trying to explain to sole proprietors that the money that they take out of their business is not deductible against their business income. You know, I don't know how many times I've had to explain that over the last 30 plus years because people don't understand it. You know, but I'm taking this money out. You know, why can't I deduct it? Well, you can't.
Right.
So now if this passes, they will be able to do that.
Good.
Okay, let's see, what do we talk about next?
Lower corporate tax rate.
The GOP proposal is to cut the rate down to a flat rate of 20%. Right now we have a graduated rate that caps at 35% for corporations, and this would just make it 20%, no matter how little or how much you make, it's 20%, which is a lot simpler and probably a bit fairer. So let's see. With C corporations in particular, you know, there's double taxation. If you take dividends from your C corporation, the corporation cannot deduct that. So the corporation pays tax on their net income before dividend. Then they pay you a dividend, and then you have to pay tax on the dividend. So the corporation's paying tax on it, and you're paying tax on it. But with this new proposal to reduce the dividend income by 50% before the tax is applied, there's a nice benefit here for C corporation owners. They get a lower rate, and then they get to, you know, only pay 50% of their dividends.
Well, I think it's fair between the president-elect's proposals and the GOP proposals. The pressure to bring the corporate tax rate and to kill a lot of the different deductions and games and simplify is very, very serious, but can be a tremendous help to small business.
Right.
Exactly. So interest expense, because this is the one I really don't understand and I really want to understand it. It's important.
It is important, and I don't understand it either. But this is the proposal that interest expense is only going to be allowed up to the amount of interest income each year. And if you have excess expense, it gets carried forward until you can use it, and there's no limit to how many years that you can carry it forward. Not exactly sure what the rationale is on this particular proposal. I'd love to do some more research on it and come back to you if I get any insight on this, but right now I have no real insight.
Here's part of the rationale. For years on the Republican side, they have wanted to take away the incentives that encourages debt and, you know, and sort of a debt-financed economy and encourage equity. And the question is how to do that because of the sort of addiction to interest expense, both for mortgages and in business. The challenge here, and the reason I was surprised that the Republicans proposed it, we've gone through a period where the stock market has been engineered up with companies issuing debt at very cheap rates because of the lower interest rates and using that money to buy back stock. So we've watched the corporate world really bulk up on debt. Now, it's very cheap. But if you just took away the interest deduction, you know, you would leave a lot of corporations screaming. Now, it's a trade-off for bringing the tax rate down. It depends on how that trade-off works. But there's a clear intention here to encourage an economy to move off of the debt model, which clearly we have to do. The question is how.
Exactly.
Right.
So, yeah, I think you're probably right. That's probably what their thinking was behind this particular proposal. But it is big, no doubt about it.
It's very big, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about net operating losses. We've always had this rule that if you have a net operating loss in, say, 2016, you carry it back to 2014. You carry it back 2 years. If you can use it against profits for 2014 that you already claimed, you can get a refund. And if there's still some left over, then you've roll forward to 2015 and then use some
right.
of it against your 2015 income. And then after all of that, then you roll it into 2017, 2018, et cetera. Well, their proposal
right.
is to no longer allow the carry back. You can only carry forward. And that's always been an election that you could make. You could elect to only carry forward and not carry back. But if you neglect to make the election, and you don't carry back, and then next year you have a profit and you use it next year, they're going to come back to you and say, sorry, can't do it. You got to go back first. You got to carry back first. So if you didn't make that election, sometimes it caused a problem. So at least,
right.
you know, it would be nice to get it. If you have a net operating loss and you can carry back and get a refund, that was a nice thing because you wouldn't have had a loss if you had money, you wouldn't have had a loss. So it's nice to go back and get refunds on prior years so that you have more operating capital.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, Patty,
forward.
If Hamilton Securities could not have done this in 1998, I doubt I would be here talking to you right now.
Yeah. So the fact that they're eliminating it, while it was a pain to, you know, make sure that the client didn't forget to make the election if they didn't want to go back,
right.
you know, sometimes it was a really nice benefit to go back and get refunds so that you had money to, you know, get yourself going again if you had a loss in a current year.
Right.
So that's going away under this proposal.
Wow. So
and again,
that means businesses need greater reserves.
Indeed.
Right.
And that may be part of the incentive on that as well.
Okay, so let's turn to the President-elect Trump proposals because it's really funny, you know, to keep up with what he's saying. I start always with his Twitter feed. But there's been quite a lot of discussion, debate, proposals flying around, so it's very hard to nail down the specifics of exactly what really is being proposed. So
exactly, and these are from September.
Right, so we need to take this all with a grain of salt, because until the inauguration and until you have a couple of the key players pass Senate confirmation, we're really not going to get clear direction on this, is what's likely. So, but let's dive in on what it looks like right now.
Okay, well, you know, as of September when they put this out, they were proposing the same three brackets as the GOP proposal. So that's exactly the same. Now, they want to retain the existing capital gain structure, unlike what the GOP was proposing where you just whack 50% off of it before you pay tax on it. They want to keep it the way it is. You're paying tax on 100% of it. It's 15% if you're under 250,000 of adjusted gross income, and it's 20% if you're over 250,000 of adjusted gross income. So that would remain the same under this proposal. Interest and dividends continue to be taxed as ordinary income with no deduction, mm-hmm. same as it has been. Right. He does want to repeal the 3.8% net investment income tax and the 0.9 alternative minimum tax clauses that were in the Obamacare law.
You know, it's amazing because I can sit with somebody who's extremely wealthy, but they've been hammered by interest rates coming down, and they know it's essentially a subsidy out of their net worth into the government, because the government's basically borrowing their money for almost free. And when the government comes along and hits them with that 3.8% tax, for some reason it hits a nerve. And, you know, it can be for them a relatively small amount of money, but the insidiousness of playing the game on the yields and then grabbing back more money on a tax, this one really, I don't know, you know, you can squeeze more emotion out of a wealthy person on this one than just about any other tax increase I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. I've seen the same thing.
Yeah.
When I tell people that, oh, and by the way, the 3.8% on top of the capital gains rate, and they're like, what?
Another midnight special provision.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Trump is proposing the standard deduction of $30,000 for joint filers and $15,000 for single filers. The GOP was at 24 and 18 and 12. And basically, the Trump proposal eliminates the head of household status. You're either married or you're single. And there's no head of household status under his proposals. He's going to eliminate that one.
Right.
Okay, so there'll be a cap on itemized deductions. Itemized deductions basically would stay the same, but you can't deduct more than $200,000 for a married filing joint and $100,000 for a single. That's the cap.
So that's going to cap mortgage interest deductions.
It will.
Correct.
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, well, you know, there's already that $1 million limit.
Right.
For deducting. So I don't really think mortgage interest deductions are going to push you over these numbers, but other things might, such as a high amount of state income tax deduction. Could push.
Right. So here's who's going to get hurt. In California, where the housing prices are so enormous and you get these huge jumbo mortgages, so you're not going to be able to deduct your property taxes, which are enormous, and you're going to get squeezed on the mortgage as well. So this is kind of the Get California proposal.
Perhaps. I still think, you know, with the $1.1 million mortgage cap, for deductions,
right.
You'd be hard pressed.
You're already there.
You'd be hard pressed to exceed $200,000 on a married filing joint return with just, you know, from that. There would have to be other things that are piling on, like your state tax deduction.
Right.
Would,
and two Lexus
state income
cars.
Tax deduction
right.
would push you over over the limit. So I don't think I have hardly any clients that exceed this. I have one client that did a couple of years ago because he had a windfall in his business and he had to make a huge estimated tax payment to the state that he lived in, and that pushed him over.
Right.
So, you know, but I rarely see deductions at these levels on many of the returns that we do. He wants to repeal the death tax completely, but capital gains in excess of $10 million that are held until death will be taxed. So if you've got capital gains more than $10 million that you're holding.
So you don't get a write-up in basis. You don't get a write-up in basis the way you do now. Okay.
That's correct.
Right.
Okay, so contributions of appreciated assets into a private charity that's established by the decedent or the decedent's relatives will be disallowed. That's currently allowed. I will say that estate tax is not my forte, so I'm not going to say any more on that. He wants to change the child care thing. Right now it's a credit, and he wants to make it an above-the-line deduction. So it would be a deduction for child care or elder care. And that would even, there would be a deduction for taxpayers who use unpaid caregivers, such as parents or grandparents, which is pretty sweet. And it will be, but that will not be available to taxpayers with AGI over $500,000 for married joint or $250,000 for a single. But that's very interesting. I'm not exactly sure how the unpaid caregiver deduction will work, but we shall wait and see.
We should thank Ivanka Trump for that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. I agree with you completely. And so all taxpayers would be able to establish a new dependent care savings account for the benefit of a specific individual, including unborn children. Total contributions are limited to $2,000 a year, and it can be used for dependent care. Any funds that are remaining in the account when the child turns 18 can be used for education. So that's an interesting proposal.
So it's a little bit of a competition with 529s.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And low-income households would get a government match of 50% on the parental contribution up to $1,000, which is really nice for low-income households to help provide daycare expenses because, you know, they got to work. So that's a big help.
Well, it's interesting. I'm constantly saying to people, get a 529 account and tell all your relatives to put money in that instead of getting gifts for birthdays and Christmas, because you have way too many toys and not enough. You're not saving enough.
Exactly.
And this would give them another option because not everybody relates to 529s.
Exactly. So it's an interesting proposal. I'd be interested to hear what the details on this. And
I bet you we can thank Ivanka
for
that one too.
Yeah, we'll see if it goes anywhere. So let's switch to businesses for a minute.
Okay.
And his proposal would lower the business tax rate, the corporate tax rate, basically, to 15%. And actually, it's not just corporations. It's available for all size businesses.
Right.
GOP was 25%. His is 15%. And he would also eliminate the corporate alternative minimum tax.
Now, my understanding, a lot of this, if you look at what's been happening with corporate taxes, the corporate share of taxes has been falling steadily while the individual's been growing. And part of that is not because of the rate. It's because if you look at all the deductions and different games they're playing, it's quite extraordinary. And so part of this simplification, my understanding, is to get rid of a lot of those dirty tricks and deductions and sort of the complexity that is bringing their effective rate, you know, even much lower.
Exactly. So basically the proposal eliminates most corporate tax expenditures except the research and development credit. So basically it's 15% on your income. You know, if you're a corporate.
Well, you can still deduct cost of products or labor, right?
Sure.
It's not flat on revenue.
No.
No.
I guess I should say gross profit.
Gross profit. So it's not minus interest expense. So it's basically labor, cost of goods sold, research and development, and you know, you get to a net, and then you don't get to play the games with the debt structure.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And part of the proposal is that manufacturing businesses that are in the U.S. can elect to expense capital investment and loss and lose the deductibility of the corporate interest expense. So, you know, that's for manufacturing businesses can elect to expense capital investment. Just manufacturing.
Right.
And if they make the election to do it, they can't go back and revoke it once 3 years have passed. Once three years have passed, they're stuck with it.
Right.
So he also wants to provide a business tax credit for on-child, increase, I should say, the business tax credit for on-site child care. He's increasing that from $150,000 to $500,000. But it has to be recaptured over 5 years. Currently, on the $150,000, there's 10 years to recapture it. So while it's generous, paying it back is going to be a bit of an ouch, because
right.
You have to pay it back over 5 years.
So, and you have to pay it back dollar for dollar, the full amount.
Yes, and I'm not sure how many businesses are going to be real excited about this one.
Right.
I think it needs a little more work, so we'll see.
Right.
So businesses now, that pay a portion of employees' child care expenses, say they don't have an on-site child care facility, they pay a portion of employees' child care expenses, they can exclude those contributions from their income.
See, this is why we always want to have Republican and Democrat and nominees running for president who have working children with small children.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about this tax rate, Patty, because if this happens, just from the, you see a very wide number of small and middle-sized businesses in your practice. How much of a difference do you think this is going to make to your portfolio of small business, to small business in America? And do you think this is going to increase their investment in assets in their business, particularly if they get relief on the Obamacare?
Yeah, I do think it will increase investment. I really do. And that's one of the big things that they're trying to accomplish with both of these proposals. I don't think either one of them is going to be enacted intact. I think there's going to be a lot of give and take.
Right.
So we really don't know, which of these proposals is actually going to come to fruition. And we also don't know how long it's going to take.
Right. It could be a very rocky transition. But I'll tell you something. There is only one way. You can swing back all the corporate money and incentivize the corporations all you want, but there's only one way you're going to get an increase in jobs in this country, and that is if you take your boot off small business and entrepreneurial startups. And there's a great deal they can do. Now, tax relief is the fastest way you can get small business going, but you're going to have to do a lot of regulatory relief as well. So, I don't know. I'm looking at what they're talking about. It makes me optimistic. And, as you said, it could be 2017. It could be a very interesting transition because we've got a world of people in Washington who, when money's cheap, the way you get political power is you toll booth and you get leverage. Problem is when the economy is really needs relief and you need things to get going, you need a very different attitude. So it's going to be interesting to see how Washington copes with this.
Exactly. And, if we don't know if these things are going to pass in 2017, if I knew that for sure, I would say, if you're a cash basis business and you're planning on, making investments in your business and you can, there's a potential to fully deduct them next year. You may want to push them to next year.
Right.
But we just don't know. I think if the tax rates go down for businesses, you want to push your revenue to next year if you possibly can.
Right.
But we just don't know which of these things are going to get through and how long it's going to take. We don't know if 2017 is going to be the year or not.
See, what I would say is, if something is immediately deductible this year, I would take it this year. I would buy all my office expenses for next year. I would, I would deduct as much as I could this year because I do think rates are going to come down. And for something that's fully deductible this year, if it's only partially deductible and next year it's fully deductible, then you wait. But if it's 100 deductible this year, load up on, because we always get great paper and office supply sales in December. I would just say load up.
Yeah, and if you're cash basis, those things work. If you're accrual basis,
right.
Maybe not so much. You know?
Right, exactly.
So I definitely would recommend to anybody that's listening and thinking about some of these things to go speak with your tax advisor and, you know, see what their take is on it and, you know, put your heads together and come up with a plan.
Right, and this is not so much a tax issue, but if rates do come down and they do pull that money back into this country, for a lot of small business, there's going to be a lot of new opportunity, and you want to be thinking about what that is and how you be prepared to execute on that. So I don't know. I think it's going to be unbelievably interesting. You just need to have we all need to be like Bolo dolls next year as we watch. You know, you can really get into a manic depressive state when you watch tax reform, because one day, you know, you're going to be rich and the next day you're going to be bankrupt, depending on what they do. So, right. Okay. Well, Patty, this has been incredibly informative, and you were wonderful to go look at both the GOP and president-elect proposals, because they are not easy to unpack and make simple and clear and coherent, but you've done it once again. So before you go, could you just describe your firm, how you work, and the fact you're in Virginia, but obviously I'm in Tennessee, Solaria's in Delaware, Solaria Investment Advisors in Tennessee, and we do things all over the world. So you work with people all over the country and deal with, you know, domestic and international. So describe a little bit about your practice. And if somebody's interested, and I cannot recommend you highly enough, and I know because I've worked with you for a long, long time and lost you, which was one of the worst things that ever happened to me, but got you back. So
I appreciate
all
of
that. Strongest recommendation for individuals or business. So tell us a little bit about how we contact you if we're interested.
Sure. We are in Virginia, and we do work with people all over the country. I have clients that I've never even met that I've been working with, frankly, all over the world. Myself and my business partner, Rita Schooley, we've both been in practice in the public accounting arena for over 30 years, so we have a ton of experience, and we'd be happy to have anyone that's interested in speaking with us, contact us either by phone at 703-870-3699, or you can also look us up on the web, www.ks-cpas.com.
Okay. Well, Patty, you have a wonderful holiday season. Don't work too hard on all those estimateds. And I know I'll be talking with you before March and April 15th.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for joining us on the Solaria Report.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.